Security having arrived, I'm going to call to order the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee. This is for the public primarily. A committee can start on time even though it doesn't have a quorum, and this is for the convenience of our guests because you have come some distance, and we do have some adverse weather that will be arriving this afternoon. So we will start the committee. We can't do anything official as far as taking action on the minutes, but we can start the testimony, which is recorded and then can be reviewed. So with that, I want to call up the Minnesota State Colleges and University. And if members of the committee and the public recall, I had requested that Minn State do a campus-by-campus projection, that if they get their entire budget request, what would happen on each campus? And then if they got the governor's budget request or budget proposal, what would happen on each campus? So we'll start with whoever wishes to start first, and welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record. And members, do you have sheets in front of you with red columns and other columns? I think it's the red columns you want to focus in on. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Pelosi and committee. I am Bill Mackey and serve the Colleges and Universities of Minnesota State as Vice Chancellor of Finance and Facilities. Before starting our presentation, would like to acknowledge the several student leaders here from our campuses for LEADMN and Students United Advocacy Days. Also would like to acknowledge a couple of our bargaining unit presidents, Jenna Chernega, president of the IFO, and Nicole Emerson, the chair of MAPE, who I believe is here in another role today, as well as our other colleagues from IFO, MSCF, and others that are here. In addition, we have two presidents with us today, President Ann Blackhurst from Minnesota State University Moorhead, and Scott Olson, president of Winona State. For this morning's presentation, I will provide an overview of assumptions and process we undertook to compile the two scenarios you have in front of you related to Minnesota State's biennial budget request if it is fully funded or if the governor's current budget recommendation is enacted. Two of my colleagues will then provide information on the budget planning that is happening on their campuses. Gene Holler, to my left, Vice President from Minnesota State University Moorhead, will provide a university perspective, and Don Lewis, who's on my right, Vice President and CFO, will provide a perspective from the two colleges where he serves as CFO, Anoka Ramsey Community College and Anoka Technical College. So to start, we need to start in the current fiscal year 2023. And on your spreadsheet, that's the on both of them, that's the column on the furthest left, the FY23 structural gap. And as a system, we have an operating gap where we go head into the next biennium of about $75 million. And this is by comparing current ongoing revenues to current ongoing expenses. So the $1.54 million as a system, and then the $1.6 billion, and the $1.6 billion in expenses produces an operating gap of about $75 million. And this isn't a perfect comparison, but it gives an idea of some of the reliance that Minnesota State has on one-time revenue to support operations, as well as temporary measures that are taken each and every year in order to have a budget that can move forward on an annual basis. This overall system amount has been growing each year. If we were going, as we were headed into the last biennium, this amount of $75 million was about $47 million. And the reason these numbers are growing is, one, and the committee has seen, and it's the second bullet on this slide, the enrollment trends that we've had the last 10 years. And you see that that's been an issue at most of our colleges and universities. The second issue is the level of state support that our system and colleges and universities have received, as well as the second year of the biennium, where in most cases we don't receive new revenue and have to absorb the increases in personnel costs and others and reallocate funds to cover inflationary costs. And then the third reason I would say is we continuing to utilize one-time revenues to buffer ongoing costs. And as I previously testified to this committee, the federal HERF funding over the past couple of years was a funding stream that many of our colleges and universities used. The structural gap, how do colleges and universities address this? Because at the end of the year, colleges and universities don't show that they're short $75 million worth of cash cumulatively. What happens is there's many different mechanisms that are used. One of them, which will be the last year for this particular one, and there's a second bullet, is there's $23 million that will support a lost revenue at 9 of our colleges. The other 18 colleges and 7 state universities spent their HERF federal funds prior to fiscal year 2023, so they're forced to take more immediate actions for the current fiscal year. Some of those other actions are holding positions vacant and not filling them for some time. That would be the one-time compensation savings on the slide. Reducing operating expenses, I believe you would hear from our CFOs and presidents across the system that most of our faculty, our staff, have very limited supply budgets, very limited travel budgets, and other things because of the amount of money needed to cover overall compensation on an annual basis. And then thirdly, delaying investments. There's a lot of great strategic initiatives that are ongoing across the system, as well as facility improvements that are needed. And I think in many cases, those decisions, because of cash flow reasons, those initiatives or projects are delayed, or sometimes they're strung out over a longer period of time than normally planned. And then the last item would be utilizing one-time money that is in reserves to cover some of this structural gap that's identified. So moving to the next biennium, fiscal years 24 and 25, and just a few assumptions here is one is that our colleges and universities updated their enrollment projections on February 1st, and that complies with the Office of Higher Ed deadline where we submit that information, and then worked with the system office to update their budget projections on February 9th, 2023. So each of these line items on this spreadsheet by institution was constructed and verified by each of the college and university's leadership teams. I would point out that each institution's at a different point in the process of their short-term and long-term budget planning. So some of the institutions on the spreadsheets have already implemented multi-year budget reductions where they will see savings in 24 and 25. Maybe they implemented them in this biennium or previous ones, and it takes a series of years to see the financial savings. Others are identifying the gap and are currently in the process of planning to make those adjustments. So as we look at the gaps for 24 and 25, need to acknowledge that each of the institutions are at different points in their budget planning process, both from a short-term nature as well as a long-term nature. And that budget planning is steeped heavily in shared governance at each of our colleges and universities that you'll hear more about from my colleagues, where there's an extensive amount of input and feedback as difficult decisions are being contemplated and then ultimately implemented that ultimately affect students, affect faculty and staff, and programs and services that are offered. One additional comment I would make about enrollment is we shared with you the fiscal year 13 to 22 enrollment projections. For this particular year, our latest enrollment projections show system-wide will be down 2.8%. This fiscal year, colleges being down 1.8%. 11 of our 26 colleges, though, are stable or have increasing enrollment from fiscal year 22 levels, and our university sector is projecting to be down 4.3% for this year for fiscal year 23, and that's, in a sense, an additional column from the 13 to 22 final enrollment numbers that we shared with you earlier. What we included in this analysis to calculate the surplus and the gap at each of our colleges and universities, and this slide shows our biennial budget request in the three categories that it was brought forward: student support, Minnesota State Stabilization, and Workforce and Economic Development. In the spreadsheet that's labeled based on the Minnesota State Biennial Budget Request, there was $119 million in stabilization funding brought forward, and that was done in the way that we requested the funding. So there's new funding in each one of the fiscal years. Our student support category, as you recall, a heavy portion of that is freezing tuition for the biennium. So that out of that $34 million in fiscal year 24, $25 million of it is attributed to a tuition freeze. $9 million of it is attributed to additional funding that would go to the campuses for additional student support services. And then for fiscal year 25, there's another $50 million for a funded tuition freeze, and then that $9 million again. The governor's biennial, or the Workforce and Economic Development, you'll see zeros there. We did not allocate any of that funding to our campuses, and I'll address that later. We certainly would if we were to receive that funding, but for the purposes of this simulation, we did not. The governor's biennial budget portion, the $125 million in stabilization funding that was fully funded is included here. $62.5 million each year is included as part of the that's portion of the simulation. What's not included in the analysis is the funding to students and investments in specific programs. So the biennial budget request, what's not included is for student support. That's funding for emergency grants and transfer scholarships. That's not included in this simulation. The stabilization funding, there's a portion there not included. That much of that was for enterprise-wide technology initiatives or base funding as part of our request. And then the workforce and economic development, none of that $100 million is allocated in this simulation, with the assumption is that depending on the amount received, we would determine the process in which that funding would be allocated. Certainly all of our students would, all of our campuses would benefit from the scholarship program. How funding for increases in investments in certain programs, that process would need to be determined, and it would likely could be through some process where it wouldn't be spread equally, but in areas where there's programmatic demands. From the governor's biennial budget proposal, the portions not allocated was the $5 million for student support. Based on, we would view that funding as going towards ensuring ongoing funding for our mental health initiative and basic needs work that is sponsored at the system level on behalf of our colleges and universities. And then the workforce and economic development, $1.5 million, similar to what I mentioned of the $100 million of our request, is that we would need to determine a process on how to allocate that funding. And it likely would also involve what I failed to mention. It would also likely involve new investments that would be made at the same time. So while we're not providing revenue on this simulation, the expense that would occur also is not there. So from a system level, on the two spreadsheets, and these would be the totals on the bottom of the sum of the 26 colleges and the 7 universities. In both scenarios, we start with the gap that we bring forward in fiscal year 23 of almost $75 million. You'll see then that the Minnesota State request portion, that gap, is $20 million of it or so is eliminated, so we project that end of the biennium gap of $54 million. The governor's recommendation portion in the first year, there's about a $12-13 million difference between the two, but how the funding is allocated, then there's a huge gap in fiscal year 25 because there's no new funding coming in. The other portion that's very clear to know is there's no assumptions of a tuition increase for fiscal year 24 and 25 in the governor's recommendation model. The Board of Trustees, when they approve the system's biennial budget request, a portion of the motion that's passed is that the board, after full consultation with Minnesota State constituencies, will make final budget decisions, including setting tuition rates, at the conclusion of the legislative session. So that would likely be sometime in May, and so it's premature to acknowledge that at this point of the process.
Vice Chancellor Mackey, I also want to Thank you for including that. That was at the request of the chair. I wanted to see what this looked like without a tuition increase. And for the students that are here, there are certain members of the legislature that think a tuition increase is somehow state revenue. I have never thought of a tuition increase as state revenue. I think of it more as a tax on students, mm-hmm. a particular group of people that will take maybe a decade to pay off. So that is that was at my request that we see this without that tuition increase. Thank you, Vice Chancellor.
Another aspect of the spreadsheets that I'd like to point out is that on the far right columns, we show what the college or the university is projecting related to their enrollment changes for fiscal year 24 and 25. And you'll see in most cases, colleges and universities are planning for their enrollment to relatively stabilize. There's a lot of 0.0% or less than 1%. Generally speaking, if there's a gap of anticipating or projecting a large enrollment decline again in fiscal year 24, the size gap for fiscal year 25 is generally a larger number. And that goes along with what we've testified previously to the committee is that our colleges and universities manage to their enrollment and much of the funding that we request goes to cover inflationary costs. So reductions are being made and will still need to be made at many of these colleges and universities regardless of the outcome because of the enrollment declines. On the other aspect of components of our budget request that we've testified previously on too is that the components that are not allocated directly to the campuses here are investments that will help with enrollment in the long term at our colleges and universities, funding to provide more services and more support for individual students outside the classroom, as well as the funding for workforce and economic development to build and expand programs where there's need, create the current learning environment, equipment and facility-wise that's needed to produce more graduates for the workforce of Minnesota. So as you look at these spreadsheets, and we can certainly take further questions on them, you'll see that there is quite a bit of variation based on where campuses started in fiscal year 23 and what their enrollment is projected to be are probably the two main factors of how large that structural gap is when we get to that fiscal 25 surplus and gap column, which is your third column from the left in both simulations. So Mr. Chair, with your permission, that concludes my part of the presentation. And with your permission, I turn it over to Gene Holler, Vice President for Finance and Administration at Minnesota State University Moorhead.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Good morning, Chair Pawlowski and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gene Holler, and I am Vice President for Finance and Administration at MSU Moorhead. And I am passionate about the purpose of public higher education. The first thing I want to impress upon you is that the stabilization funding in the biennial budget request does not mean that institutions are spending more money on the same things. We are constantly looking for ways to remain efficient, effective, and relevant in order to accomplish our mission to transform the world by transforming lives. Because of the lead time necessary to strategically plan for an academic year, MSUM's budget planning process begins 18 months in advance of the fiscal year. Our consistent, transparent process honors the principles of shared governance and is stewarded by our University Planning and Budget Committee. The committee is a 24-member representative group, which includes students, two of whom are with us today. Garrett Herrinen, our Treasurer of Student Senate, and Max Thompson, our Student Senate President. Both serve on the UPBC. UPBC holds open meetings throughout the academic year that culminate in providing input and feedback on the proposed budget plan to the administration. During the budget planning process, we review all university expenditures in relation to the available revenues, and we make reallocations from low priorities to higher ones. To illustrate, MSU Moorhead has eliminated over 87 positions during the past several years, which represents about 12% of our workforce. And we closed 11 academic programs, some of which include paralegal, theater, gerontology, Spanish education, and our undergraduate degree in philosophy. And we recently launched several new high-demand academic programs, a nursing undergraduate program, graduate programs in social work, criminal justice, and athletic training. And we transitioned our school psychology to an online program to serve more students. MSUM has also experienced operating budget pressures. We are particularly interested in the bill introduced by you, Chair Pawlowski, that would eliminate the statutory requirement that requires post-secondary institutions to provide a third of the debt service for our capital projects. This would prevent further strain on our already tight operating budget and would represent savings for MSUM of $267,000 in user financing for our Weld Hall renovation project, which is Minnesota State's number one capital project request. Although we have been diligent about budget planning, it's unfortunate to note that our enrollment has been declining at a faster pace than we've been able to reduce expenses. In the competitive higher education market, MSU Moorhead has implemented many new strategies to address the enrollment losses. We implemented a tuition reset to achieve parity with the amount charged for online courses and in-person courses. This important revenue-neutral tuition reset benefited our students with simplicity, transparency, and predictability in their tuition costs. We updated our automatic scholarship offerings to align with our top competitors, both in Minnesota and with bordering states, in order to drive enrollment and proactively market our quality and affordability. We launched a new marketing campaign with a focus on equity, inclusion, individual student support, and pathways to success. We are working to embed equity and inclusion both in and out of the classroom so the student experience aligns with our marketing efforts. We provide flexible options for students to continue advancing towards their degree with our 8-week courses and our first winter term. We invested in programs that improve student success, some of which include our GRIT program, which is for conditional admits from disadvantaged populations, our Smart Start program for first-year students from diverse populations, and we provide financial grants to remove barriers for students wanting to participate in our learning communities. We launched a new learning assistant student mentoring program in difficult science courses to help boost student success. We work to increase awareness of basic needs support that is available to our students through our Dragon Pantry, as well as through other services in our community. And we partnered with the Education Advisory Board to conduct market studies to help guide our investments in our new academic programs. All of those efforts to bolster our enrollment. MSUM relies on state appropriation to serve our students and our region. Without the requested legislative funding support, MSU Moorhead will face significant and sobering deficits in both years of the upcoming biennium. We will be forced to eliminate more faculty and staff positions. We will be forced to make cuts that will jeopardize critical academic and student support services that are necessary to recruit and serve the needs of an increasingly diverse student body. We will be forced to defer technology and facility investments that are necessary to ensure safety, security, and operational efficiencies. Ultimately, these reductions will result in an erosion of the opportunity for all Minnesotans to create a better future for themselves, for their families, and for their communities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I appreciate your commitment to public higher education and to Minnesota State. Mr. Chair, with your permission, I would like to turn the presentation over to Don Lewis, Vice President for Finance and Administration at Anoka Ramsey.
Vice President Hollinger, I'm going to just pause for a second because you brought up the savings from the one-third deduction of $67,000. We learned some information about that, and I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Hopkins. Can you explain what we learned yesterday and to the committee? The bill was put in as a repealer, but yesterday we learned something else.
Sure, Mr. Chair and members. So the reason for the user financing requirement for the bonding to fund capital investment projects with higher education institutions. There's no statutory requirement for the user financing. It's actually just been placed in previous bonding bills. So if the bonding committee doesn't put a user financing requirement in its bonding bill this year, there will be no user financing requirement. So it's really up to the bonding committee to make that decision.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins, and to everyone in the room. I serve on the Capital Investment Committee, and I've already reminded the chair and staff that we're not going to include it. So you wanted to turn it over to Vice President Lewis. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Pulaski. Distinguished members of the committee, I thank you for providing me the opportunity to speak with you this morning on both the joys and the challenges of financially managing several Minnesota State colleges. For the record, my name is Don Lewis. Presently, I serve as the Vice President of Finance and Administration for both Anoka Technical College and for Anoka Ramsey Community College. I serve two distinct and separate colleges. This is somewhat unique within Minn State as it aligns several institutions so that it may share a number of administrative services. The two colleges function with one shared president, one CFO, one integrated business office, integrated HR, technology, and a handful of other back office operations. The alignment between Anoka Tech and Anoka Ramsey commenced approximately 10 years ago and has resulted in the two colleges saving around $750,000 to $1 million of administrative expenses on an annual ongoing basis. This has been a godsend, particularly for Anoka Tech, which has been addressing budget challenges and academic stabilization for a number of years. Challenges which many of our technical colleges share due to the high cost of equipment, the need to keep that equipment representative of what is used in the field, and a need to have smaller class sizes for effective pedagogy and for campus safety. But the financial benefits of establishing aligned institutions also has its drawback. Primarily thinly stretched administrative departments with very little wiggle room remaining to adjust staffing and workloads as finances become tighter and tighter and tighter. Over the past several years, enrollment declines related to the pandemic and a legislative underfunding of higher education has placed the college on a precipice of financial cliff. The only difference between the cliff that Anoka Tech stands on and the one for Anoka Ramsey is the slope of that downward trajectory on the first step over the edge. The downturn in revenues at Anoka Tech over the past several years, coupled with the projected shortfall over the next few years, requires a need to reduce the college's operating budget by close to 20%. In order to close this gap, Anoka Tech is assessing its ability to continue much-needed services that support student success. The availability of tutors, they're disappearing. Retention coaches and advisors, they're not available or accessible. And student support services are under constant pressure. In addition, eliminating or downsizing academic programs or course offerings have already been implemented into the program, and we continue to look at other opportunities that we need to take into serious consideration. This past year, Anoka Tech enacted an early retirement program and a reduction in force within the faculty ranks. And open staff positions continue to be delayed in being filled or not being filled at all of which is placing significant stress on the college's ability just to get the basic work done. In addition, not sufficiently funding Anoka Tech places an overwhelming hardship on the college's ability to develop new or expand programs to meet the needs of businesses and industry, particularly in the Northwest suburbs. Workforce demands are huge, and the college's commitment to training the next generation of Minnesota workers is outstanding. Yet the college lacks the resources needed to outfit space with equipment, build new curriculum of study, and to take a risk with smaller classes sizes that might be necessary as a new program gets launched and established. Program growth, and with it, an ability to serve the Minnesota workforce, has taken a back seat during these financially challenging times. Anoka Ramsey Community College also stands on the edge of a cliff, too. However, the drop-off is not as dire as at Anoka Tech. But enrollment declines and general governmental underfunding is taking its toll. Anoka Ramsey continues to monitor course offerings and the timing of these courses, limiting flexibility in times and frequency of courses right at a time when students are needing such flexibility to align with their work and their life situation. Finally, such a funding gap is also puts pressure to further delaying the college's already long list of deferred maintenance projects. In the end, only adding a greater downstream cost and yet another financial strain when these get undertaken, or a growing dependency on tapping limited HEPR funds for more general routine repairs. However, there are signs and glimmers of hope. With additional funding, enrollment and retention services may be enhanced, and efforts are underway to already begin that process for both Anoka Tech and Anoka Ramsey, and we're optimistic that that trend in declining enrollments may be abated. With adequate funding, Anoka Tech may continue to leverage its very strong partnership with Anoka Hennepin Public Schools, which includes the embedding of two high schools within the physical plant at Anoka Tech. This relationship promotes a seamless transition from high school into college. Also, the economic climate of Minnesota currently is so robust that the demands of business and industry is grabbing our students well before they can complete a degree. The college has now recognized this situation and focusing attention on getting more students through the door initially, becoming their go-to source to begin their technical education and training, and if the job market steals them away prematurely, keeping that door open to them and welcoming their return at some point in the future. Anoka Ramsey also benefits from strong K-12 partnerships. These high school partners are vital to enrollments. Anoka Tech is encouraged by an excitement among our faculty and staff to focus on new and innovative ways to improve student retention. And funds have been set aside and reallocated in order to launch some new retention initiatives. The college has created a proposal system and are floating ideas for our faculty to say how can they improve retention and completion within their classrooms. We will begin to review these proposals within the next month and begin to implement those that we believe will really help with the retention efforts. For even a single digit percentage increase in retention will have a meaningful impact on enrollment numbers. However, all of this work will become moot if the colleges continue to be underfunded. Chair Pulaski, I could go on and give you more stories about the life at Anoka Tech and Anoka Ramsey, but I want to thank you right now for listening to this story and listening to me right now. I encourage you to support robust funding for higher education, and I deeply appreciate your commitment to our students and the next generation of Minnesota workforce leaders. Thank you.
Before we go to questions, Representative Wolgamont has a motion for us.
Was I at this meeting, Mr. Chair?
Yes, you were. Made sure before I asked.
All right. Well, just making sure that these are correct, and in that case, I do move the approval of the minutes for February 16th, 2023.
Representative Wolgamont moves the minutes of the last meeting. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Wolgamont. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here today. And thank you especially for the spreadsheet. Very much appreciated. We have a previous spreadsheet that the chair had requested showing 10 years of enrollment change that ended on FY22, and then this one doesn't talk about enrollment for FY23 and begins with your projections for FY24. So I'm wondering if in a future presentation you could provide us with sort of the change between FY22 and 23 and then link it to your ongoing projections, because that information of trend is very important to me and I feel like we're missing that column.
Chancellor Mackey, you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins, thank you for the question, and it would have been helpful to have that projection on the spreadsheet, and we'll certainly get that to the committee.
Representative Davis?
I have one more.
I'm sorry, Representative Robbins, you're not finished. Continue, please.
If I can ask one more question, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Th- Thank you. So I appreciate the conversation about all the challenges and all the ways that you are looking at every dime and cutting programs and cutting staff. And that was a concern of mine in earlier hearings that, you know, we want to see that you're partnering in helping control costs. And I definitely see that and appreciate that. One of the costs that I don't see in the model or projected at all is how the colleges will pay for the proposed paid family leave program, 0.7% of payroll. So is that accounted for in these models? And if not, how do you expect that will impact your budgeting decisions?
Vice Chancellor Mackey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins, I believe we have some of our collective bargaining agreements that already have paid family medical leave within that, so that is costed in here. We have not costed out or included any new proposals that may not be in our current contracts.
Representative Robbins, I see some people nodding in the audience too, and it looks like the representatives of the IFO for sure and others are nodding, but Representative Robbins.
Thank you. And I have not looked at the college's collective bargaining agreements, but I have looked at the state collective bargaining agreement and some of the school district collective bargaining agreements. And the state collective bargaining agreement does not meet the standards in the HF2 proposal. So if you are not fully meeting everything in HF2, you will have to comply. Just want to make sure you're aware of that.
And Representative Robbins, we haven't passed that one yet, have we?
No, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Robbins, I just want to emphasize we have not passed that one yet.
Thank you.
There are others who have concerns on House File 2. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Mr. Lewis, I recognize right away that your comment that you're linking some of your Anoka Tech and Ramsey College with the schools, 11th and 12th grade. Out in Wright County, we have Wright Tech, which the students, I think it's 11th and 12th grade, have an opportunity to go to the Wright Technical Building in Buffalo. Schools bus them there, and then they learn great trades of electrical and building homes, and my son is in it now. So a question partly to you and then to the chairman. The chairman's, one of his goals this year is hoping to relink K-12 to colleges, especially technical colleges, which sounds like you're doing already, and certainly we need that. But Mr. Chair, how is that funding mechanism? How will that work, and how are we going to fund if we do continue to link and more colleges like Anoka Ramsey will incorporate high school students within their college for learning the trades? How is that going to be funded?
Representative McDonald, we're working that out with K-12 right now. And you've seen some bills introduced. Representative Purcell just introduced a bill, and I signed on to it. There are going to be some interesting variations of how that's going to happen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't sure if you were, I needed to be recognized.
I know again. I lack specificity, but that's the best answer I can give you.
No, that's good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So question then to you, Mr. Lewis, is that, do you know some of your other colleagues, some of the other technical schools are adopting some of that same principles that you are doing?
Vice President Lewis.
Thank you. I believe that there are several of our sister schools that are following a similar approach. Perhaps Vice Chancellor Mackey has more detail than I have on that. Regarding the finances of it, the benefit for direct benefit for Anoka Tech is that we have a rental agreement for the space that we get from the district, which helps for the occupancy of the space that they're taking over. But more importantly, particularly for one of the colleges that is embedded is a alternative high school for students that have had to drop out of the regular high school program and are re-entering it into a program, and their part that we've got embedded are for those who are now in their senior year of high school, and they're between the ages of 18 and 23, I believe, are the students that are in there. One of the requirements that they have to have as a senior in that program is every semester they have to take at least one course and in the college. It could be in any discipline that they want. So we use PSEO, for example, to help fund with that. But it gets their feet wet in actual taking college courses and whatnot. And it's been a great way to retain those students once they graduate from high school to keep them going. Many of them take more than one course, but that is a requirement for them. The other high school we have is called a STEP high school, which is a secondary technical education program, which is part of District 11's program. It's been embedded within the school for a good 15 to 20 years. They have a standalone building, but yet they share a lot of our lab space and a lot of our faculty and a lot of our resources. So we have an agreement that we work out with them every year in terms of the shared approach to various things. But the biggest advantage for Nokotech from a financial standpoint is it gives us a beautiful pipeline of students into the future.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Lewis. That seems to be our future. You know, I'm just an ordinary Joe from Delano, but if we're going to save our institutions and really educate our kids to go into the trades, in addition to the four-year college degrees, which are very important, then this is the way to do it. And we have a good chair at the helm that's going to see to it that it gets done this session. So thank you.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Vice President Lewis, for your comments. You made one comment I'd like to be a little more specific on. You said we need robust funding. Can you explain your definition of robust funding?
Vice President Lewis.
Thank you. I used robust twice, and I remember I have to go back into my notes and check. Maybe I'm using the wrong one.
Well, Mr. Chair, I like robust.
I love robust.
Representative Davids, I think I can assist the Vice President. The numbers that you saw here were if the system entire request were funded. Mm-hmm. So I hope his definition of robust would be if the system gets its entire request.
In that sense, exactly right, Mr. Chair Pulaski. You speak the truth there.
Mr.
And if that robust was even above and beyond what the system offered, I wouldn't be upset.
Okay. Well, Representative Pulaski always speaks the truth.
You can keep buttering me up until the end of session.
Whatever it takes, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Davids, are you?
I am done.
All right, Representative North.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vice Chancellor Mackey, I just wanted to quickly check on the spreadsheets, what the system is requesting, the governor's recommendation, particularly when you look at Minnesota State University Mankato. You will see that there's a surplus when you look at the system's request, and there's a significant gap, almost 9.9 million up to 10.9 on the, if you look at the biennium changes 24-25 and fiscal year 25. How do you explain that big shift in that process?
Vice Chancellor May.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuer, the shift would be primarily in the spreadsheet titled Governor's Recommendation. There was no funding for a tuition freeze. So this plans on having 22-23 tuition rates moving forward into the next biennium and not having that portion of revenue available to cover inflationary costs. And Mankato, being our largest university, their budget is in excess of $100 million. So even the amounts that are shown the surplus of $761,000. They have the largest number of employees, the largest amount of everything. So the $761,403 is significant dollar-wise, but as a percentage of the budget, they're able to manage that either way.
Representative Nor.
Thank you, Vice Chancellor. So I've got another question, Mr. Chair. The question goes to Vice President Holler. You spoke about communications and marketing. How much are we investing in communication and marketing overall from institution to institution?
Vice President.
Mr. Chair and Representative Noor. At our institution, we have, I would say, in our university communications and marketing budget, it's probably about 3-4% of our overall budget is in our university marketing communications. That includes our staffing as well as our operating budget for that area.
Representative Dorn.
Mr. Chair, do we have an overall budget throughout the state, mid-state system? Also, do we have funding coming from OHI in terms of communications and marketing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuer, we do have some funding that comes for specific programs that we implement with our students on behalf of the Office of Higher Education, and it's usually very specifically a relatively modest dollar amount or a small percentage of the total program that's utilized. At the system level, there's some marketing that's done on behalf of all 26 colleges and 7 universities, but the vast majority is presidents determine locally the amount of funds of their budget they allocate towards marketing, and that does vary depending on what the enrollment management plans are at each of our colleges and universities and where they normally get their students or where they're seeking students from new markets.
Representative Norm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is something that we need to be looking into in order to improve the enrollment and also provide support to the institutions. We need to look closely in terms of communication and marketing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad that Vice President Lewis brought up the point about retention as a way to improve enrollment. Do you guys track, I guess when we talk about retention, students of color are most at risk of not finishing on a regular track. And so do you guys track retention among students of color, and have you guys seen an improvement in retention in those student groups?
I'm sorry, Vice President Lewis.
Thank you. Yes, we do. We track retention both at Anoka-Tech and Anoka-Ramsey of students of color, as well as first generation students and various other demographics. At Anoka-Tech, we've actually improved our retention and completion of students of color, and granted, still not stellar, but it's going in the right direction. We still have work to do at Anoka-Ramsey. Our retention rate of students of color is not where we want it to be, and that's partly why we're taking a look at how can we actually commit some resources to improve that area. So the commitment is there. We just need to come up with some implementation plans to improve that. One area that we're seriously looking at is to embed some tutors right into the classrooms and help students, and they're particularly students of color, who are struggling primarily with basic math and basic English skills. And if we can get to them sooner, then we've had a better success rate. So we're taking a look at doing that, and are committed to improving that, because our numbers at Anoka-Ramsey are not where we want them to be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to, not just to Anoka, but to all the colleges and university, to continue to address the retention rates for especially minority students. I think this has been also an ongoing issue for statewide, and so I hope that we continue to see more efforts around that.
Vice Chancellor Mack.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vang, I would add that all of our colleges and universities track retention, as Vice President Lewis mentioned. At the system level, part of Equity 2030 is creating more visible and transparent student success accountability measures, and an equity scorecard has been developed. So this was done with the idea of more intentional effort to have available disaggregated data across the system to help support the use of evidence-based practices and data-guided decision-making. So we've had a lot of strong leadership across the system in moving that forward.
Representative Colton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. I have a few questions here, and they're kind of scattershot, I'll be honest with you right now, because it's just the way I think. Looking at this spreadsheet based on your budget request here, first of all, I guess I just want to make sure I'm reading it correctly. Am I correct in understanding that the column labeled FY24-25 biennial change, that is in essence the FY20-25 surplus gap minus the FY20-23 surplus gap? Am I correct in making that assumption? The math comes out to me the same, so I just want to make sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct.
Okay, thank you. And
Sam Colter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Apologies. And I guess
you know, what jumps out to me here is, I mean, this is, in theory, sort of based on your testimony, your best case scenario. This is what you're asking for. And, you know, just looking at that column in particular, we see by my count 10 institutions whose essentially the sort of the structural deficit is worse off than in 2023, and some pretty significantly here. Century College, 1.4 million, Minnesota State Moorhead, 5.7 million, North Hennepin, 1.1 million, Winona State, 1.8 million. But there just seems to be a really significant sort of disparity in that result. And I'm just wondering if you could speak to a little bit about why that is and you know, in sort of broad strokes, how those decisions were made, and, you know, essentially, I mean, why that is, I guess.
Vice Chancellor, ma'am.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would say there's two major factors that relate to that. One is the recent and projected enrollment future of each of those institutions. And so, well, if the biennial budget request is fully funded, the operating cost base inflation would essentially be covered. However, the loss in revenue due to enrollment decline, which is adding to that gap, there would need to be measures taken at each college and university affected to get their budgets structurally balanced. The second impact of it is each college and university is at a different point in their budget planning process. Some institutions, and I believe Vice President Holler mentioned it, you know, implemented some significant budget adjustments a couple of years ago, and the savings occur over a number of years. We have other institutions that are more at the beginning of that process and will likely be implementing that during this time period to address those. And then we have others on the spreadsheet where the numbers aren't as large, where they're able to, if their enrollment's stable, they've been able to make less permanent or one-time adjustments to manage from year to year. So it's really locally the presidents are delegated to manage their operating budgets, and where they are in their planning process is all a bit different from time to time.
Representative Colter.
Thank you. That's helpful. And I'll probably have more on that at a later date here. The second question I have, and maybe this is something we can talk about offline, it would be, I think, helpful to know how these enrollment projections are determined, because, you know, I look, there are some in particular, again, the big shifts are the ones that jump out to me, but you see, for example, Bemidji State has an FY24 projected change of 8.4% and an FY24 decline of 8.4%, and FY25 projected increase of 3.7%. And that, I mean, that's a significant change. And so I guess, you know, like I said, maybe we can take this offline if that would be better, but that makes me wonder kind of, you know, how those numbers are arrived at.
Vice Chancellor Mackey.
Mr. Chair, Representative, coincidentally, we just had a meeting in recent weeks with the leadership team at Bemidji State University, so I perhaps have more intimate knowledge than I normally would. With our universities in general and with Bemidji State, the new enrollment every year generally comes in two categories for undergraduate. It's new entering freshmen and new entering transfer students. So based on where the university has been, based in starting, say, in fiscal year 2020, they know that they have less students in their pipeline of those that matriculated to be sophomores, juniors, seniors, and then to completion. So that's built into their enrollment assumptions, and that knowing at this point of the process that their enrollment is going to be down next year. However, for fiscal year 25, the new leadership team at the university has implemented some very aggressive enrollment management strategies where there's a belief that they will be able to significantly grow the new entering freshman class, new entering transfers, as well as Vice President Lewis mentioned, the importance of retention has also improved the student success rates at the university. So all those components are built into those assumptions and why those projections may be so dramatically different from one year to the next.
Representative Cole.
Thank you. Just a couple more, hopefully quick questions. I'm wondering if, and this is definitely something you could send via email, if you could provide something of a brief history of sort of the structural deficit that you've seen. And I'd just be curious to see, I mean, if we're looking at, you know, FY 2023 at roughly $75 million, if you'd be able to send sort of the past maybe 5 to 10 years of that, just to kind of give us all an idea of kind of how that's changed, as you know, as we've talked about state funding and that sort of thing over the last decade. I just wanted to clarify something I thought I heard, and it struck me. Did I hear you correctly? You said that the for the FY 2024 request for the 34 million for student support, did you say that 25 million of that was directed at the tuition freeze?
As Chancellor Mack.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the student support component of our request, 75 million out of 125 million over the biennium, is for an undergraduate tuition freeze.
Sorry, could you?
Representative Coulter.
You said 75 of the 125 million?
Yes.
Okay. I must have just misheard you then. That seemed like a really low number to me for a tuition freeze, so I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you.
Chancellor Mackey.
Mr. Chair, Representative, related to the structural deficits, we have as a system, fiscal year 20, it was around 58 million. Fiscal year 21, it's been about 40. It was about 47 million. So it is at a higher point right now. One of the complicating factors of that is we had the federal money that came between March of 2020 and for some institutions all the way through current day. And that added to the deficit a bit because they're using one-time revenue to cover ongoing costs. And now some budget adjustments need to be made when that funding goes away. But we can certainly get you more information on that. But it is somewhat skewed over the last 3-4 years for sure by that federal funding.
Representative Klebar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm glad that Representative Coulter says he has scattered thinking, so do I. And we were kind of, I think, in the same space about the structural deficit piece. So as I'm looking at your request of $212 million, and I still see all of this red on the page, right? I'm concerned about the chicken and egg effect, right? If we continue to have this much red on a page, how are we going to be able to have the programs, the supports that will help us improve enrollment, right? So the question I have is the request that you're making enough?
Vice Chancellor Mackey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cleavorn, many would argue that it's not enough to cover our entire structural deficit, as you note. I would articulate that there's $212 million as part of this simulation, but then there's $138 million that is not. And that component of that $138 million, much of it is for scholarships to build capacity in programs where there's high demand in the workforce, as well as to ensure that we provide the student services that our students need, focus on mental health and basic needs. And we believe investments in those areas, which that are not on the sheet, will ultimately help with those enrollment figures, as well as having the core funding needed on this sheet to stabilize the institutions. And I believe one of my colleagues has mentioned in front of this committee is that we view this budget request, the stabilization portion in particular, as a down payment on the future of Minnesota State colleges and universities.
Representative Cleavard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you're talking about structural deficits of in 2020 of $58 million and then in 2021, a $47 million. Is that what I heard? Is that correct?
Yes. Chancellor Mackey.
Okay. If we were able to erase that structural deficit, would that shift these numbers on the page dramatically?
Vice Chancellor Mackey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cleavorn, yes, if there was funding to take care of past structural deficits, it would significantly change the outcomes in both cases.
Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, and this will be my last real statement. So when I, when you come to the committee, right, it's so helpful for us to have those facts and to know that I believe we have a responsibility in creating those structural deficits. I've heard you come time and time asking for a full budget request and we, the legislature, not giving it, right? Not doing what you're telling us you need. And now we are blaming you for tuition hikes and for loss of students. So I'm just asking always that when you come before our committee, let us know what you truly need. And you've heard me say this to the University of Minnesota also. So if eliminating that structural debt would greatly improve the ability of the system to have a clean start, if you will, and move forward, then that's really important piece of information for all of us to have, especially when we're in a time of surplus. So thank you very much for all the great work that you do and the service you provide to our students.
Any further questions, members? Seeing no further questions, I want to thank you for providing this information on relatively short notice. I would encourage members to save these sheets for reference. When we do get a target, these sheets will come in very handy as another comparison. And with that, meeting is adjourned.